Welcome to Finding Proof, where we discuss all things early stage VC.
We're your hosts, Thanasis and Jenny of the Proof Fund, and our goal is to get to know the best seed and early stage VCs out there.
Today, we're speaking with Nick Adams, who is a managing partner for Differential Ventures, a New York City-based early stage fund that invests in data science and artificial intelligence-driven businesses. Nick, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate having you to talk to Jenny and I. Let me start with asking you to first tell us about your fund. What is the fund about and what is the strategy?
Sure. Yeah. So I'm one of three managing partners here at Differential Ventures. We're a New York-based seed fund, now investing out of Fund 2. And we're really focused on data-oriented solutions. So anything from infrastructure architecture of AI to platforms for data scientists to data science better within the organization, and then applied AI solutions as well.
So talk to us a little bit about what the genesis of that focus is.
Yeah, so I come from the operations background. I guess that's what we call it when you work in startups before. Fortunately, had the chance to work in sales, marketing, product management, and brought a lot of the last generation of AI machine learning solutions to market from a product perspective and from a sales perspective, and really just saw the band-aids and bubblegum we were using on the back end to make the technology work. At the same time, we're going through a pretty substantial shift in terms of computing power and modernization of enterprise solutions. When I was on the operations side, I'd made up my mind I wanted to invest in really the next iteration of true AI machine learning solutions that we had the computing capacity to do so, and expected that a lot of bigger enterprise organizations would need to modernize their tech stack over the next 10, 15 years. I fortunately met my partner, David Magerman, who's a much deeper technical resource than I am, to help diligence and support our companies along that journey.
And tell us a little bit about how you view AI. I mean, AI can mean so many different things to people. Translate for somebody that maybe is not as familiar with how you leverage AI technology. Talk a little bit about how you see that space.
Yeah, AI is definitely an abused term at this point, without a doubt. For us, I think my partner David has said this best of, it's always called AI or machine learning until it works, and then it becomes an algorithm. So for us, we're not necessarily looking for the next great algorithm that's out there. It's really not our domain. It's going to be remarkably hard to source and diligence, and there's probably some kid at Stanford that has been working on this forever. So for us, we're kind of AI skeptics in a lot of ways, in that we've seen a lot of the past failures and mistakes made. So I think we're much more of the nuts and bolts of making machine learning work, much more of the data science side of things than the whiz bang factor of robots taking over the world and cars flying around everywhere. We're much more ground up, nuts and bolts, probably the plumbing, a bit more of the boring infrastructure around what actually makes AI go into become a truly an algorithm that works.
AI is now being touted as the promise of the future. And in fact, a lot of universities are building AI programs specialized in computer science, et cetera. What is the promise of AI to you based on what you've seen? What does it mean to a layperson looking at the promise of this technology? Is this going to take everybody's job away because it's going to automate everything? Or is this going to open up new opportunities to do things we can't do today? Where does it stack for you?
The unfortunate answer is both. AI is both going to create an amazing amount of opportunity in the market in terms of efficiency. And we just saw US employee productivity jump for the first time in several years. And I think a lot of it is truly the adoption of much more data-oriented, data-led solutions and technology. What scares me most is that there are a lot of jobs that are going to be replaced and are not going to come back. And I can sit here and argue all day about all the other great jobs are going to be created. The US will remain on the leading edge of innovation and technology, but I can't forget the people who are going to be hurt by the adoption of technology. And we've got, if you go through Detroit, if you go through West Virginia, you can go through a lot of parts of the country and see where this has happened before. That part scares me a lot. So I'm hopeful and excited about AI machine learning, and also very realistic that it's going to have real societal repercussions that the US is not always perfectly equipped to deal with in a smooth way.
Got it.
And what are some trends right now that you're seeing that are particularly exciting for you?
I think one that's just super interesting and relevant for a slew of different use cases, but certainly for a lot of hiring and social causes, is de-biasing data and algorithms as a whole. And it's not as simple as just making adjustments to the algorithm in most cases. There's a whole process around what your data sources are, how they're labeled, how your algorithms are trained, and how you monitor those outputs over time to see if there is drift or bias being introduced to your data or to your algorithms. That can be applied to lots of other less interesting things than how we hire and debiasing ourselves as hiring managers, as investors, and just as human beings, certainly in the financial world and so forth. But I really like that use case.
And you guys typically come in around the pre-seed and seed stage, right? How do you work with your portfolio companies and how would you describe yourself? Are you a hands-on investor? How would you define that?
You're exactly right. We do come in at pre-seed or seed. We view every seed round these days as having three rounds to it.
Right.
Pre-seed, seed, and potentially a late seed. We actually invest at all three and we modulate our investment profile based on how we're investing and what we think the company needs. I definitely consider us a hands-on investor. Our job, our goal is to help companies get from that, not to quote Peter Thiel too much here, but that 0 to 1 phase. Really help founders and entrepreneurs become CEOs, CTOs, COOs of their company that are ready for that Series A and beyond. And we do that in a few different ways, ranging from sales, marketing, product side of things that me and my partner Mitchell have lived through in our careers, and then really the deep tech side of things from David's perspective.
Right. Do you want to maybe give an example of a portfolio company that you've worked with in that capacity?
Sure. One of our latest stage companies is a company called Ocrolus here in New York. Really focused on data extraction, normalization, and validation in the underwriting world. Got most of their traction in selling to fintechs and alternative lenders, and then branched into the mortgage space. Have raised a bunch of money recently.
Just for somebody who doesn't know that, what does that mean? Like, what do they do with it? They give us an example of what they do with the data.
Two things. So they extract the data very quickly. So if you're applying for a loan for your business, let's say, or even as an individual, you have to put up a bunch of financial information that's sensitive, but leads to the ultimate underwriting decision of the lender. So you put in financial statements, sometimes tax returns and other background information about your financial status. And it's a very competitive market for the fintech. So the faster you can turn that data around, and in their world's called decisioning, make a decision faster, but also accurately, is critically important to the success of these fintechs. And Ocrolus does that literally within minutes in some cases and with a 99% plus accuracy rate, so that borrowers get decisions fast and lenders feel good that they can get to a decision quickly, but also not unnecessarily put their portfolio at risk by lending to places where they don't want to be lending. So Ocrolus takes all that data, extracts it, puts it into a format that's easily digestible by the lender and their underwriting systems, but then also helps them because of all the massive data set they've collected of all these financial statements and other identifying information, they can help identify fraud and other analytics really early on in the process to just make a more robust and transparent lending environment, which has been really helpful. So for us, we invest in seed rounds. I joined the board in 2018 with some other great investors like Paul Martino from Bullpen Capital, Maya Scarity from QED, Dan Petrozzo from Oak HCFT up in Connecticut and Philadelphia, Laconia Capital. We just have a good group of people around the table, but we divide and conquer. I'm really good at helping Sam and Vic and the team at Ocrolus around sales, marketing, their overall strategy for the business, fundraising, and just becoming better leaders. If their CTO, Peter, wants to talk about data or AI or infrastructure scalability, then go talk to my partner, David Magerman, directly, who's infinitely more knowledgeable and skilled in those areas. And our incentives are aligned, so we operate pretty flat and get people right to who they want to speak to faster.
This sounds like a horizontal technology innovation that is applied to a specific vertical. How often do you see platform plays that apply across verticals versus specific applications for a very specific customer? I mean, the customer in your example is probably like a fintech company, right?
Yeah, you're totally right. So I now consider Ocrolus a vertically applied AI solution in our portfolio, a true fintech. The reality is they started out doing document processing for accountants, law firms, everywhere you could imagine until they found their real product market fit in this alternative lending world. So you're spot on. They do have an underlying technology that can be applied to a lot of different use cases, and they found their niche. The interesting thing about investing in these, I'm going to call vertically applied AI solution that uses a technology for a specific use case over and over again, is that they get traction faster in the market. You see that ARR growth sooner. But then over time, if you really want to become a $1 billion-plus company, you need to keep expanding those use cases, right? Whereas when we invest in a platform or even infrastructure, the inverse problem is often true, where There's so many different things you could do with an NLP platform, for example, natural language processing platform, that you need to narrow down some specific use cases and focus customers on what they are and market that more clearly before you start seeing the revenue traction. But the upside can be much greater when you have that overall platform in place.
How do you think about that challenge for finding product market fit at the pre-seed stage? Because you're talking about new technology, new potential solutions, right? And you obviously are betting on a team, but how do you guys process that internally? How do you think about, okay, we should invest in these guys because I think this has the potential to do X? Because sometimes you can't even predict what the technology will be applied to.
You bet. First of all, I think it's something that we're good at helping our founders work on and sort out. We tend to probably overselect for more technical founders with some sales and marketing chops, but that we can help them a bit more. Our operating partner, Jeremy Kirsch, was my boss at Opower in DC, was their CRO from zero to IPO and 150 million in recurring revenue and so forth. So we bring Jeremy in as our go-to-market SWAT team leader, and it gives us a little bit of a buffer between our founders and our investment decision makers in some cases. I can just help them work through some different iterations of how to test things quickly, iterate quickly, and adjust when things don't go exactly as planned. I think first and foremost for us, when we're making that investment decision, especially if we're going into a pre-seed round, is we like to follow founders who really know the space, either from their past world or academic experience, whatever the case may be. So we're hoping to lean on them, but just from a structure and iterating quickly and adjusting, that's where we tend to put some guardrails on the process.
And about how many companies do you fund a year, and what's the average ticket size and all that good stuff?
So we typically do somewhere between 8 and 10 deals per year. Our check sizes range from $250 to about $2 million for our first check-in. We usually reserve about the same amount for follow-on capital into our portfolio. So we tend to deploy portfolio sizes somewhere in the range of 22 to 25 companies overall.
Got it. And what was something you and your co-managing partners, when you started the fund, what was something about that process that maybe you weren't expecting or something that surprised you in that process?
There's probably a laundry list of things that were surprising.
Opened up a can of worms, I know.
Yeah, I would say the things that we adjusted for most in Fund One were portfolio size. So I was hoping to raise $30, $40 million. We ended up with $20 million for our first fund. It was what it was. So we had to adjust a little bit and figure out which of our rules were more guidelines. And what we decided was we weren't going to get to a portfolio of 22 to 25 companies. We really like leading seed or pre-seed deals versus following most other seed investors, unless they're really well-established funds. I'm proud of and know we put a lot of work into our diligence process and how we look at a company, how we look at technology, how we document everything and feel good about the support that we provide. There are just so many funds and angel investors out there. When we were looking to follow some other newer funds, we just didn't see the same level of diligence all the time. So we ended up leading more than I expected in Fund One. So we ended up with 16 portfolio companies. We led 7 of those rounds, and our average first check size was $550K. And I modeled in 400 to 450.
Right.
But that was just the market. That was the market. We needed to write a little bit bigger checks. We needed to lead a little bit more often. And so far, I stand behind it. The other kind of lingering issue there is follow-on capital. We will end up getting tapped out of our follow-on reserves out of the funds sooner than I would have liked, but it creates interesting opportunities for our LPs and others to pass those pro rata rights through to them. So that's our risk mitigating the things that we had to adjust for in the fund strategy.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. And then I know you touched on it briefly, but do you want to go into your background a little bit more?
Sure. So I grew up in the Boston area, did my undergrad at Brandeis, played baseball there, was going to be a lawyer, knew very quickly after a few months of working in a law firm, I couldn't have hated anything more.
Sure that other people share that sentiment.
Yeah.
Myself included.
Yep. I worked in a law firm. I didn't grow up with any money. So I grew up lower middle class, I would say. So the thought of taking on more debt was a little scary. So I had worked in this law firm all through college. I felt pretty good making $12 an hour and had a great experience, actually. And I didn't have a whole lot of white collar role models to know what to do. I liked playing baseball and I had one uncle who was a lawyer and the rest of my family was pretty much police officers and dug holes for the city of Beverly or the city of Boston. And mercifully, when I came to this 22-year-old oh shit moment of I just wasted 4 years of my academic career, somebody hired me into a technology startup that just raised a Series A in Boston at that point in time, 170 Systems. Raised $10 million from Polaris Ventures up in Waltham.
Yep.
And I just got my feet wet in sales and got to do a lot more there because it was a startup. I got hired away to a competitor that was a European company, publicly traded over in Finland of all places, and was employee number 6 or 7 in the US. And I got trusted to do a lot more than I should have at 25 years old. Ran sales there in the US, grew the company to about 15 million in North American market, and left, went and joined Jeremy over at Opower before their IPO, which is amazing. Worked with some incredible people. And then I went and launched a natural language processing solution for a company called Rage Frameworks up in Boston that we later sold to Genpact in India. So I got to do a bunch of different things really early on in my career. I went back to school a couple of times in there. I got my MBA at Northeastern. I did a master's in global finance, split between NYU and Hong Kong University of Science and Technology. And somewhere in there, I just got tired of the operations side of things. I'd always had venture in the back of my mind, and the time was right. I'd made enough money to go take this risk and try and start a new fund, which I naively and overconfidently went into officially in 2017.
And what was it about investing specifically that really interests you?
I always liked being behind the scenes and empowering people. It was just always comfortable for me. I mean, go deep into therapy here. It goes back to my childhood, probably. I have 2 younger sisters who are 10 and 13 years younger than me. So in high school, I was changing diapers and feeding 2 kids. So I definitely had a unique perspective on the world. And it was like having 2 kids of my own when I was a high school and college kid, and definitely changed my view on things. And as an employee, I always felt like I was a better manager because I like giving people the information to be successful. And I did that even when I didn't have direct managerial responsibility. And as an investor, that's it. We write a check, we do our thing in the background. But I always say, like, you know, there are days where my role is to carry the bag for Sam Bobley, the CEO of Ocrolus, and plug in his laptop to a projector. And there are days where I need to step up and lead a board meeting, and fortunately have the intellectual capacity to be able to do it. But I also like being very much in the background and supporting founders or my partners or our associates to be really great. And I always say, we're kind of like, if you're into hockey at all, like a fourth line venture capitalist who's going to not score a whole lot of goals maybe, but is going to go out there and dig in the corners and maybe get in a fight here and there to protect his teammates.
Always need one
yeah,
of those.
Yeah, you need one of those. Yeah.
We've had a number of people that started similar to how you did, right? Like operational background, and then decided to start a venture fund. I don't think we've ever talked about, kind of talk to us about the process of how you decided that. Who did you talk to? Where did you seek advice? And how did you get from being an operator to starting a venture fund?
Really good question. So when I went back to grad school in 2016, I knew my last company was going to be sold. So I was winding down there and thinking about what was next. And I had always had venture in the back of my mind since I was a dropout paralegal in 2003. And I'd learned about it through my networking process and how I landed at 170 Systems. So I went back to school and said, this is the year I'm going to do it. I'm going to go back to school. I'll probably be fired from my company once they're acquired. And I'm just going to put my mind to it. And at the end of the year, if I'm not in venture capital, then I'll probably have to go get a real job again. And it worked out for me in my first week of school, literally sitting in Hong Kong, November 2016, a couple of days after that election, and we're going around. I said, I'm Nick, I'm from Boston, working startups, I'm looking to go to venture capital. One of my classmates pulled me aside after, said his brother was leaving a fund in New York and I should talk to him. His brother also happened to be an alumnus of the program we were doing, the grad program. He connected me to Laurel Toby at Flatiron Investors, now Supernode, joined her as a venture partner about 3 weeks after I got back from Hong Kong in December, and just kind of hit the ground running. And it wasn't really the right fit for me to be a second general partner there, but I got a great taste for venture capital in the first year. And I just talked to pretty much every VC and my old friends and colleagues in the startup world and cobbled together a couple $1 million to go out and start investing and see where we could make a couple of good bets. Fortunately, the first one was Ocrolus, and continue raising money. And that was definitely the most naive part of my naivety and overconfidence at that stage. But fortunately, the early investments, the thesis, and then my partnership, especially with David Magerman, came together in just all the right ways.
And who did you go to for your first capital, for the first fund? How did you start? Did you go to friends from connected through your business experiences or?
Yeah, I pretty much hit up anybody I worked with previously that I knew had made a couple of dollars on an exit, some family, and a couple of people I worked with in the venture world. And I blame my good friend Ashish Mehta, who was my boss at Rage Frameworks for a while. He wrote me my first check and helped me meet a bunch of other people. And he put up $250,000, the entire capital call day one, no questions asked. And we just got to work. And $250,000 led to a bunch of $25,000, $50,000 checks early on, which you need a lot of those to get to 30 or 40 million. But eventually we got a couple million together And it was mostly friends and former people from the startup world, which is great because I got diligence help from them, got help opening doors for customers. And that's what helped get us into Ocrolus. Honestly, we knew the business well. We were able to make some really valuable connections for them that led to their biggest customer at that point in time. And when there was a round coming together, we were barely a fund, but Sam and Vit carved out a little bit of room for us and we wrote a small check and took the board seat. We're off and running from there.
Well, that's awesome. Congrats on that. It's not an easy feat for sure. Having been in sales and clearly excelling at that and also providing a lot of value in that capacity and advice for your portfolio companies, what advice would you have in that arena for entrepreneurs that might be listening?
Sales is both an art and a science. You have to know the basics, the fundamentals of outreach and what the right tools are. And you have to be thorough in your outreach and testing who you're reaching out to and how you're reaching out to them. And you've got to be a little bit persistent in the middle of part of the funnel. And you also have to know when to pull the plug and realize you've been going about this the wrong way. And that's the art part of it, is knowing when to walk away. So I would say be nimble and be willing to try a bunch of different things. You're going to spend 80% of your time on one sales approach into one ideal customer profile. Carve out another 20% where you can just try some different things and see what sticks. And be flexible on product, but don't just chase the money. Sometimes it can lead you down the wrong path and the wrong types of revenue. And you end up with a business that you really weren't expecting to have and probably can't scale. So it's a challenging thing, but I think finding the ideal customer profile as quickly as possible is the best that you can do. And then you decide like how much time to spend on top of the funnel versus really pushing through that ideal customer profile at the middle and bottom part. It's just going to take some time early on when you're new. And secondly is I love a product-led growth and I love the bottoms-up sales strategies. There's never been a real example of a company just magically flying off the shelf without founders begging and pleading their former colleagues or friends or whatever to try out a solution. And it scares me every time I'm in a pitch meeting with a founder and they say they're going to take the Slack approach and just got to take off from the ground up. Like Slack begged dozens and dozens of customers to use their product early on and sold top down, I would argue, before they were really able to build the unbelievable ground up product-led growth business that they are today. So
right,
just gotta roll up the sleeves and do it. Get out of the Excel spreadsheet and make some phone calls.
Right. And what are some other red flags that you've seen during pitches?
That's the other one. I've seen the most beautiful Excel spreadsheets, models, cost acquisition. It's really hard to measure if somebody is going to have the capacity to get out of their own spreadsheet and talking about what selling looks like and just getting out there and doing it. And that's always the scariest part to me. Beautiful Excel spreadsheet is great, but they make me very nervous at the seed stage, to be honest.
So moving on to our four standard question segment.
Let's do it.
Our first question is the National Venture Capital Association. The NVCA advocates for public policy that supports the venture community and the American entrepreneurial ecosystem. If there was one thing that you would change about the VC industry or one policy that you would advocate for, what would it be?
It would actually be right along those lines. For me, it's training and retraining. I think the US misses this boat way more often than it should. And there are so many great ways to take people who have been affected by other shifts in the economy and other changes in technology and retrain them and get them into good jobs that we're sorely in need of today. And I'm not just saying coding and development jobs, although I do think there's a great opportunity for things like what Lambda School's been doing in terms of training up new data scientists, people who don't want to go spend $200,000 on college or $250,000 on college. But if they can become a great engineer through a program like Lambda School, that's a win for them and for the economy. But also things like the energy world. There are so many people who were in an industrial market or in coal or something like that, that can be retrained for home energy audits or commercial and industrial work around energy upgrades and assessments and so forth. We just need to put all these people together and put the right funding in place. I think it would be really, really good for our economy. So that's my big thing, is training and retraining across all parts of job skill and the economy.
Great answer. Number two, if you weren't a VC and money wasn't a concern, what career would you have?
I always said that if I couldn't play shortstop for the Red Sox, I'd want to be in venture capital doing what I'm doing today. So that part came true. And I'll say 22, it was very clear I couldn't be a shortstop for the Red Sox. It's probably a lot earlier than that, but kept the dream alive through 22. So that would be my first choice. Short of that, I'd definitely be in the education world. Actually, as part of my 22-year-old midlife or post-graduation crisis, I spent a lot of time talking to people about becoming a teacher or a guidance counselor or something like that. So I think I'd probably be in that world.
Well, that's interesting. We've actually had a couple of guests that have wanted to be educators as well. And to your point about why you love investing, that makes a lot of sense. What subject would you teach if you were a teacher?
I'd probably do something around economics. I love economics. I was actually a history and legal studies major in undergrad. So I have a soft spot for history. I've learned a lot about just researching and writing through that. And it's always interesting to see history play out right in front of you and in real time too, in current events. So maybe history, but economics really excites me a lot now.
It's going to be a hell of a history book for the past couple of years. My God.
Anything happened? I haven't noticed.
I know, right? Exactly. <Yeah. laughs> What hasn't happened is the question. Right. Number three is, who is someone that you look up to and why?
Well, I've got to throw my grandfather out there. He's been gone for about 10 years now, but my parents were divorced really young. My dad died when I was 6, and I mostly grew up with my grandparents. And my grandfather taught me an awful lot about an awful lot. And he gave the example of people in my family who dug holes. He literally worked for the city of Beverly in Massachusetts and dug holes and plowed the streets and all that stuff. So I grew up around truck drivers swinging by the house, checking on my grandmother and I, make sure we were good. And that always felt like home to me, but he always pushed me to be a better athlete. When I was a kid, he was like, Nick, learn computers. And he didn't even know how to turn the damn thing on, but he's always pushed me to learn computers. So I programmed goofy little games when I was 6, 7 years old on my Apple IIc. And when I was older and actually working in technology, the closest he got, that's when I was selling like accounting software, was Nick Sells Computers. And I was like, we'll take that. Let's call that a win. So my grandfather was up there, more current and a little detached from my family, is Daniel Kahneman and what he's done around helping me and hopefully lots of other people understand how our brains work and bias. And I think one of the most important things we do as investors is not to hide our bias or run away from them, but to be aware of them and acknowledge them and figure out how to mitigate them as part of our investing process. And it's the most important book I ever read. And I'm just generally fascinated by how our brains work and how we make decisions. So what he's done, and now Adam Grant, I've started. I'm a big audiobook guy, and I've gotten to Adam Grant's books from University of Pennsylvania. My former associate, Tiffany, had his classes, and she convinced me to start listening to his books, and they're really good.
Yeah, they're super interesting. Yeah. Didn't he write Originals?
He did. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm doing Think Again right now. Think Again's pretty good. Yeah.
Awesome. We'll have to check that out. Finally, what's the best piece of advice that you've ever received?
I've probably learned more about life and business from being a baseball player than I have through other parts of life and business, to be honest. And my college coach, Coach Farney, was naturally unbelievably gifted athlete, 3 sports star at Harvard, played 10 years professional baseball for the White Sox and the Braves, was infinitely better than any of us that played for him. He had a great saying that was, you're never as good as you think you are. You're never as bad as you think you are. And I can remember him saying that to us when we were 12-0 coming out of my sophomore year, coming out of our Florida trip. And I remember him saying that to us when we were like 1 for our last 14, which was pretty rare. We had a good program. And it's always stuck with me. Baseball is a very strange game where the whole game is predicated on failure and a little bit of mental abuse. And that saying is always stuck in there for me. You're going to have great days. You're going to have not so good days, but there's always a turn coming at you. So you gotta stay pretty even keeled. I think that's unbelievably true in the venture capital and startup world.
That's really great advice. I'm sure he'd be appreciative that you mentioned that too.
He's finally going into the Hall of Fame at Brandeis this year. So maybe I'll dust this off and show it to him as a part of the clip. Yeah.
Love it.
He'll probably just tell me, don't forget I'm not as good as I think I am. And
Well, Nick, thank you for joining us today. We appreciate your time and enjoyed learning a lot about you and your fund.
Thanks for having me.
And follow us on Twitter @ProofVC or on our website @proof.vc.